We have a small attendance here tonight, but that doesn't mean we can't have a good service. I hope we can have an excellent class period together. You know, Jesus once preached one of his most powerful, meaningful sermons with one in the audience, the woman at the well at Sychar. Discourse that we often quote. That's where he said that we're to worship God in spirit and in truth, and we quote that almost every service. But tonight we're going back to the Old Testament. This lesson features an Old Testament woman who is probably unknown to most of you. She does not play a major role in the course of Israelite history, although it was a very real one. Her life intermeshed with the life of others who were very prominent, too, especially King Saul and King David. I believe that she has received a bad rap from most New Testament or Old Testament commentators and from the preachers who have followed their interpretation as though it were written in stone. It's troublesome to me, and has always been, that someone a long time ago can put a given, uninspired interpretation upon something in the Bible, and then preachers and teachers for generations afterward will adopt it without question and perpetuate it until the point comes where no one dares challenge it. I've studied this woman's life and affairs off and on for many, many years, because there's some things about it that really interest me. I've done that both in Scripture, in the commentaries, of which I have quite a few sets at home, in published sermons, and in lessons. And I've drawn my own conclusions, which differs from the mainstream view. I believe that view is flawed because it is based on unfounded assumptions, which I will point out in the course of this presentation tonight. This view that's so popular and longstanding vindicates one popular biblical character at the expense of this woman. But in my view, she was far more nearly on the right course than that other character was, and I want to vindicate her tonight with a more honorable explanation. Her name was, and I will spell it first, M-I-C-H-A-L. Everyone pronounces that Michael, but during her lifetime, no one ever said it that way. She would not have known what you were talking about if you had called her that. The proper Hebrew pronunciation of her name is Michal, which is just as easy to say as Michael. Michael's a boy's name. She was Michal, and that's what I'm going to call her the rest of the time tonight. She was the youngest child of King Saul, the first king of Israel. She had four brothers and one sister. Her oldest brother was Jonathan, whom we know well, because he became the devoted friend, the steadfast friend of David. Michal grew up in a town named Gibeah, which was on a high hill just a few miles northwest or northeast of Jerusalem. Saul established the first capital of Israel there. It would be wrong to call the residents there a palace just because kings live in palaces. Archaeologists over the years have excavated that site thoroughly. In Arabic, it is now called Tel El-Ful. They've concluded that the place was far more of a military fortification than it was a plush king's residence. But yet, in the state of things at that time, it was probably the best building in the whole area. Michal seems to have been rather beautiful, and as befitted a princess, she would have worn the best clothing available at the time. her early life appears to have been quite happy, but it certainly was not to stay that way. Her father, it all began, really, when her father brought into the court from Bethlehem a very handsome and talented young man who had slain the Philistine giant Goliath and was highly skilled at playing the harp and composing beautiful songs. As Michal was a typical teenage girl and saw David frequently, she naturally fell very much in love with him. She doubtless wanted to become his wife, but her older sister named Merab stood in the way. Back then, a girl had no say about whom she would marry, and that was more true than ever if she were a princess. Who a princess married was determined by the king, and that was for reasons that had absolutely nothing to do with romance. We read in 1 Samuel 18, verses 16 and 17, "And all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, 'Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles.' This union would have made David the son-in-law of the king, a very great honor, especially for someone who up to that point had really only been a shepherd. But Saul had an ulterior motive that was evil. You see, he had already become insanely jealous of David, and he wanted to kill him and get him out of the way. He felt that it would not be good to do it himself, and so he thought of a plan to get others to do it for him. So he told David that in order to marry his daughter Merab, there was a condition. He had to go down and kill 100 Philistines and bring back physical evidence to prove it. He thought that David would surely be killed trying to do that and solve his personal problem. In 1 Samuel 18, verse 17, it states that Saul thought, "My hand shall not be against him. Let the hand of the Philistines be against him." When David was carrying out this mission, and he did it entirely successfully, Saul did something that was irrational, but that became par for the course for this king to do irrational things. He gave Merab in marriage to a man by the name of Adriel, who was from a wealthy family over in Gilead, east of the Sea of Galilee. This was doubtless a very great disappointment to David, but he wisely held his feelings inside. Saul, however, was afraid of David, and he did not want to provoke him too far. As he pondered what on earth he could do to make amends, it came to his attention that his other daughter, Michal, was very much in love with David, and he thought, that's it. There's the answer. We read in 1 Samuel 18, verses 20, 21, when they told Saul, the thing was very agreeable to him, and he thought, I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Then Saul set the very same requirement he had made in his first offer for marrying Merab. To marry Michal, David had to go back down into Philistia. He had to kill another 100 Philistines and bring back physical evidence to prove it. Taking a legion of his own men with him, which he had accumulated by now, David lost no time and making an incursion down into Philistia. Instead of killing 100 this time, he killed 200 and brought back grisly trophies from their bodies to prove it. This grieved Saul very deeply when David came walking in alive and strong and victorious, rather than being brought in on a shield, bleeding and dead. But this time, Saul had to keep his promise. So we read in 1 Samuel 18, verses 27 through 29, "So Saul gave Michal, his daughter, for a wife. When he saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal loved him, he was even more afraid of David." Saul's next attempt to eliminate David was this. He commanded his son Jonathan, who was Michal's older brother, to murder David, or to have him murdered. But Jonathan refused to do that. By this time, he had become very, very close friends with David. He wouldn't carry it out. Not long thereafter, as David was playing the harp for Saul, 1 Samuel 19, verse 9 says that an evil spirit came upon Saul and moved him to hurl his spear all of a sudden at David, in order to pin him to the wall. But David was very watchful, and he saw this act beginning, and he managed to dodge it, and he ran from the house of Saul to his own home, which really wasn't very far from Saul's. That place wasn't that big. Verse 11 then states that Saul then sent messengers to David's house to watch him, in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." And knowing that she spoke the truth, David climbed out a window and was lowered to the ground on a rope by Michal. What occurred next is recorded there in verses 13 through 16. Michal then took the teraphim, which was a little humanoid-looking image, probably carved of wood, and it says that she laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said to them, "He's sick." These men looked into the bedroom. I don't guess they went any further to see Michal's exhibit. They were convinced that that was David lying there sick, and they returned to Saul to tell him what they had seen and what Michal had said to them. But Saul had no sympathy for David whatever, feeling good or very sick. He commanded these men to beat a path right back to David's house and to pick him up, bed and all, and bring him right to Saul. Then he says, "Bring him to me on his bed that I may put him to death, verse 15. When they got back to David's house to transport him, they discovered the hoax that had been played on them. Saul, when he heard about this, was enraged, and he just flew off the handle toward his daughter, Michal, for doing this. He said, "Why?" He bellowed it to her. He said, "Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he had escaped?" You see, it was obvious to Saul's own family that Saul had it in for David and meant to kill him. Michal, it is very noteworthy, put her life on the line this night in performing this deed, because her father by this time had become mentally unstable, and it got worse as time went on. He might very easily, right then, have executed Michal for what she did. To show how unstable he was, it was only very shortly after this that one day he became irate at his own son Jonathan, and he actually cursed him vilely. In 1 Samuel 20, verse 30, we read that Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." Folks, if that were put into Tennessee common English, it would not be said from this pulpit. It was vile, it was hateful, it was rough, mean, and cruel. Hate and fury were burning like a blazing fire in Saul's heart. Verse 33 says that he picked up his spear and he hurled it at Jonathan to strike him down. When this King Saul was enraged, he was capable of anything, cursing his own son in the vilest language and then trying to murder him right on the spot with his spear. So you see, this shows McCall narrowly escaped being executed by her father when she played this hoax to give David the time to get away. Her love for her husband was very deep. Mark that in your mind. It plays an important thing later on. But McCall did not escape scot-free. She did not get free of her father's wrath. It's reported in 1 Samuel 25, verse 44, that he took Michal and gave her in marriage to a man by the name of Paltiel, who was the son of Laish of the town of Galim. It made no difference to him that he was giving his daughter, who was married to another man, to someone else. You see, there was no provision in the law of Moses that gave Saul the right to do this. But Saul at this point did not care what the law required or what the law forbade. He was continually by this time defying the law. Being king had gone to his head and had made him a tyrant. You know, they say that power goes to your head, and that absolute power absolutely goes to your head. That was Saul at this point. With no way to prevent it, Michal now had two husbands. This Paltiel, to whom she had been given, and the one that she really loved, David, who was now banished from the kingdom out in the deserts of Judea, fleeing before Saul's armed band that was after him. Saul, or rather, God in heaven, though, was not oblivious to what was going on. He was looking down upon all this, watching it, and he finally responded by rejecting Saul as the king. Saul was soon after this defeated on Mount Gilboa. And before the Philistines could get to him to stick him full of spears and arrows, he killed himself. Not only did God in that way remove Saul as king, but he did not allow a dynasty to proceed from Saul. That is, none of Saul's sons were allowed to succeed him as king. One of them, named Ishbosheth, tried it, but he failed. He was assassinated. He didn't last very long. You see, God had already anointed David to become Israel's second king, although at first, for 7.5 years, he only ruled over one tribe, the tribe of Judah, and that was from a town in the extreme south of the land, Hebron. By this time, though, David had already taken two more wives, Ahinoam and Abigail, that we heard a lesson on here a few weeks ago. But he got to thinking about Michal, living way up in the north part of the country in Galilee, the wife of some guy named Paltiel. He thought, hey, she was my first legal wife, and I should have her. She should be mine. She should be right here with me. So he ordered his military commander, who at this time was a guy by the name of Abner, to go and bring her to him. And this is reported in 2 Samuel 3, verses 15 and 16, in what is to me one of the saddest scenes in the Old Testament. I mean, sad. Here it is. And Abner took Michal from her husband. That is, they barged into the house. He grabbed this woman and said, "She's going with us." Paltiel, the son of Laish, could do nothing but look on. But this man loved her very deeply, and it says that as they went along, he followed behind her weeping and followed her as far as a place called Bahurim, which was several miles. Imagine walking, crying for several miles. Then Abner said to him, "Get out of here. Go, return, go home." And so Paltiel turned around and went. You see, David at this time was the king, and he had an army to enforce his will. He had the power, and he used it to seize Michal in her home and to carry her away down to him, to his court in Hebron. How Paltiel felt, who by this time had been her husband for a few years, did not matter one whit to David. The man who had come to love Michal dearly, as he showed by following after her all of those miles, crying and crying, did not move Abner, did not move David. Abner finally got tired of that guy walking along behind crying, and he roughly ordered him to turn around and go back home. In Tennessee English, he said something like, "Beat it, man, get out of here. Go back home." You didn't fool with Abner. Abner was a ruthless kind of man. He would have killed Paltiel in a flash if that poor man had dared to object one word. Folks, I consider David to be very, very wrong, very much at fault in all of this, in the way that he seized Michal to drag her back to him. He already had two wives, and he was about to take several more. He did not need Michal, and there is no indication anywhere in Scripture that he cared for her. Although the Bible clearly says more than once that Michal very much loved David, and never one time even hints that he loved her. It seems clear that he wanted her for one reason: pride. After all, she was a princess. She was a daughter of the previous king. She had forcibly been taken away from him and given to this man, Paltiel, who seemed to have had nothing to say about it either. To take her away then from this Paltiel and restore her to him, David, as his wife, would be a public demonstration of the whole land of David's power and his final act of triumph over King Saul, who had been such a great enemy to him. Folks, it would have been better for Michal, better for David, and certainly better for this Paltiel, if David had just left her where she was and had forgotten about her. And the next event, which closes the record on Michal, will clearly show that. After ruling for 7.5 years at Hebron as the king of only one tribe, Judah, David then became the king of all Israel, and he decided to move his capital up to Jerusalem, which had just been captured from the Jebusite natives. And so he decided to make Jerusalem not only the political capital of the land, but the religious capital as well. And that necessitated bringing the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem and housing it there in a temporary shrine until a temple could be built And that was in David's plans too for some time. On his first attempt, David messed up badly. Rather than transporting that sacred chest by staves carried across the shoulders of priests walking, he had it carried on a cart because that's what he wanted it carried. And this resulted in God striking dead a priest by the name of Uzzah, who reached up at one point to steady the ark when it was jostled by the cart as it hit a rut in the road. Then David again reacted badly because God had upset what he, David, wanted to do. All of this was David's plan, not God's. And when God brought this forth, this death of Uzzah, David got very angry. We're told in 2 Samuel 6, verses 8 and 9, that he became angry because the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. He got mad because of what God had done. And it says that David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the ark of the Lord come up to me?" See what was important in David's mind? Me. I want the ark brought to me. God is preventing it. I'm mad. Evidently, some priest or prophet told him. They said, "David, the answer is very simple. Just transport the ark the way the law of Moses says, and all will go well." When David finally got himself under control and his anger cooled down, he took that advice and had no trouble bringing the ark on into Jerusalem. But that leads to the grand finale to the story. David had this transporting of the ark into Jerusalem done with a great deal of fanfare. It was in a procession of a multitude of the people with tremendous shouting and blowing of trumpets, offering an animal sacrifice in the middle of the road. David led this parade. He was king. He led it. And he led it in a way that was physically very, very active. It is described there in verse 14. It says, "And David was dancing before the Lord, with all of his might, wearing a linen ephod." His movements were not restrained or inhibited because he had a great deal of passion inside him and he wanted to let it out. Therefore, he was extraordinarily hyperactive and exuberant. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, which is the Cadillac or Rolls Royce of Bible encyclopedias, used the word cavort to describe his action. And in a biography of David by the Jewish author Jonathan Kirsch, in a book titled The Life of King David, published in the year 2000, I have it in my library, Jonathan Kirsch describes this way, quote, "To demonstrate his piety, and we might imagine to make sure that every eye was on him alone, David took off all of his royal apparel and wore only the brief linen ephod, the customary garb of a priest. Then the handsome king capered and whirled like a dervish." Folks, an ephod only went down a little bit below the waist. That's all David was wearing. And at this point, Michal comes into the picture. We read there in verse 10, "And as the ark of the Lord came into the city, Michal looked out a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in his heart." Up to this time, it is said three or four times in the text, she loved him. Once she risked her life to save him, but now it says she despised him. When the ceremony ended and David came into the house, verse 20, Michal spoke to him. And it's very rebuking kind of talk. She said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself in the eyes of the maids like someone foolish. That is, if there had been nobody out there but men, that would have been one thing. But there were a lot of young, unmarried women out there, and they saw it all. Michal was thoroughly embarrassed and humiliated by her husband. You see, by dancing scantily and kicking his legs high in the air, he had shamefully exposed himself before the crowds, especially these young, unmarried women. Folks, there are vivid paintings from Egyptian tombs from David's day and a long time before that that depicts in vivid color this very kind of dancing, even as part of a religious celebration. This wasn't something known only in Egypt. Right here, this is one of the volumes of The Great Ages of Man by the Time Warner series. This one is on Egypt. And here is a picture of some dancers. Now, I know you can't see it too well, but there's four dancers right here. This is from the tomb of Nefkhetai, who lived about 2,400 B.C., about 1,400 years before David. This is on the wall of his tomb. This is in a tomb that is called a mastaba at Saqqara, Egypt. I've been to that place. I've been down in some of those mastabas. I didn't go into this particular one. There's lots of them there. It's like an underground house, room after room. Every room tremendously decorated with the best paintings and the best colors available at that time. Those show four women bent over as far as they can bend over, standing on one foot, and the other foot is as high in the air as they can get it. These young women are wearing nothing from the waist up and very, very little from the waist down. And when they kicked that foot high in the air, what they were wearing no longer did any good. That's the kind of dancing that David was doing. It was well known at that time. David simply exposed himself publicly because of what he was doing. And I am fully convinced that Michal's criticism was 100% justified, and that David had indeed, like she said, acted foolishly. More than that, he had acted sinfully. It has disappointed me through the years that preachers and teachers, and I've heard several of them give expositions on this, vindicate David and blame Michal for criticizing him. They accept David's justification in the next verse there, verse 21, that as the king whom God had selected, he had the right to celebrate the way he wanted to. Did he? Just because God appoints a man a king, does that mean he's free to do what he wants to? He did not deny Michal's words that he had danced hyperactively and exposed himself. Look in verse 22. He as much as admits it there. He said, if I expose myself to those women today and want to do it again, I will. Nobody can stop me. You see, he felt that as king, he had set his own standard, and he was justified in doing it. But brethren, there is no provision in the law of Moses for any kind of dancing in religious observance and ceremony. It was done sometimes, but it was not in the law. Many things were done that weren't in the law. And for Christians to do it today, the situation is the same. We can't do anything like that in worship. 1 Corinthians 14:40, let all things be done properly and in an orderly manner. What would we think if we had a preacher to come in here and all he was wearing was one top that came down just a little bit below the waist, and at some point he started dancing up in the aisles, kicking his heel up above his head? What would we think? No different then than now. And God has certainly never approved the exposure of the private areas of the body in public. That's something very private. not even skimpy clothing that facilitates it. David is usually exonerated by quoting, but David was the man after God's own heart. Says that twice. Once in the New Testament, once in the Old. But folks, that statement does not mean that David was sinless. We know some terrible sins he committed. Adultery, murder, outright defiance of God's law in going on and making a census of the land that cost 70,000 people their lives. How would you like to disobey God and it caused 70,000 people to die? He was wrong in what Michal charged him with. I don't believe that anybody can convincingly vindicate him and fairly put the blame upon Michal. They cannot to me. Not at all. I admire her for her criticism, which resulted in a great disadvantage to her, which is pointed out in verse 23 there that closes the record. It says that David sequestered her, no longer acted as husband to her, so that Michal had no child until the day of her death. I feel only great sorrow when I consider Michal, who appears to me to be a virtuous and a well-mannered woman when she is fairly looked at in the Old Testament records. She was given to the man that she loved very much only after she had been once passed over. Then after she got him as husband, she was taken away from him and given to some other man. Not because she wanted another man, but because her daddy wanted it. Some years later, when she had finally become accustomed to living with this Paltiel, she was taken away from him by force and led back to satisfy David for one thing: vanity, pride. When she saw David acting lewdly coming into Jerusalem in that parade, she accused him to his face, and what did he do? In great anger, he flared back at her. Then he confined her. He shut her up the rest of her life. She truly loved David. She risked David one day that could have caused her to lose her life that very night, but there's no evidence anywhere in the Bible that David loved Michal. And looking back before that, there's no evidence that her own daddy, King Saul, loved her. Michal was unfortunate in being the daughter of King Saul, and she was as unfortunate in being the wife of King David. She doubtless did not live a happy life. I sincerely hope that beyond the grave, God gave her a place of eternal rest and joy in heaven. And folks, personally, I bless the memory of Michal, this Hebrew princess of antiquity who was badly mistreated and misused and now practically forgotten. I'm very glad that this evening I have the honor to vindicate her publicly, something that I have wanted to do a long, long time after hearing so many people give David all the credit and excusing him and casting all the blame and contempt on a woman who was perfectly right.